Hi, I'm Nino Ricci, the Alice Munro Chair in Creativity at Western University, and this is Who Do You Think You Are? Each episode, we talk to someone from the Western community who is making a difference in their field by challenging old assumptions or forging new models for how we make sense of the world. These are people who are showing us that creativity lies at the heart of innovation in any field, whether it be business or law or history or the sciences or the arts. They're also showing us how creative solutions often come from building bridges across the disciplines and breaking down the barriers that often blind us to new approaches. We're here today with Lorelei Lingard, someone who wears an impressive number of hats. You're the founding director of the Center for Education Research and Innovation here at Western. You're a professor in both the Faculty of Education and the Department of Medicine. You're recognized internationally as a leader in research on medical education, and last year won the prestigious Karolinska Institute Prize for your work in the field, the first woman to win the prize, I might add. And yet you came to all of this through a rather unlikely route, through the study of rhetoric, which to me is a field that, you know, conjures up Aristotle in the Athenian Forum debating the sophists, and I think for many people conjures up a question mark. So I guess my first question to you is, how did you come to rhetoric? How would you describe rhetoric, and what made you think that it still might have relevance for us in the 21st century?
Thank you for the invitation to be on the podcast today. So I came to rhetoric as someone who grew up in a family that loved language. Always knowing that I loved language, I went to graduate school in English in the humanities, but did not want to take the literature track. And one of the other few tracks available in English is the study of language, either linguistics or rhetoric. So I chose rhetoric, which, if I boiled it down, is the study of the social uses of language. So yes, classical Aristotelian rhetoric is about oratory and persuasion of the crowd. And in healthcare, rhetoric is about oral discourse and using language to work together to deliver care. Uh-huh. So really, the context is different, but a lot of the principles are the same. Language matters. It's what we use to get things done together.
Okay. It's still a bit of a leap, though, going from, you know, being in the heart of the humanities to becoming a researcher in sort of the enemy camp, or what we often think of as the opposing camp of the sciences. So what was the route that brought you into research in medical education?
So for me personally, my interest in medical language started when I became pregnant with my first child. Mm-hmm. That was when I was doing my doctoral studies. At the master's level, I had studied advertising rhetoric and had thought that that was probably where I would continue. But regular healthcare visits and overhearing and participating in the way that healthcare providers talk made me realize that that was a place where a rhetorician could ply her trade as well. So I did my doctoral studies looking at how third-year medical students learned to tell the rest of the teaching team on the inpatient ward about what the patient is here for, and how learning to tell that story in a particular way shapes their values, their knowledge, their relationships with the patient and with other healthcare providers. So I've been in the enemy camp for almost 25 years now, since my doctoral thesis.
And I mean, I think that, characterizing it that way is a kind of false dichotomy, obviously, because
sure,
clearly so much of what happens in the medical field has to do with communication. Was anyone else sort of looking at those areas when you came into it?
Yes, there had been 20 years of really close inquiry into communication between healthcare providers and patients.
Uh-huh.
So the doctor-patient interview, for instance, how you break bad news to patients and families. There had been a lot of good research into that when I started my doctoral work, but very little study of how healthcare professionals talk about their patients amongst themselves. And
mm-hmm.
that was the area, the white space on the academic landscape, if you will, that I wanted to fill.
So why do you think there hadn't been any work on that to that point? I mean, it now seems the way you've described it, it seems like a pretty important area of study. What do you think the resistance had been to looking at that? Just nobody had got around to it?
Or? Yeah, I don't think it was resistance. I actually think that people started in the logical place to start, which is, well, how are physicians and nurses communicating with patients? That seemed a logical starting place. So I think that the other aspect of it is that the interest in teams generally in organizational research, in business research, in social psychology, the rise in the interest of teams, I think, occurred about 20, 25 years ago in a lot of disciplines. Mm-hmm. And so the sense that teams were important had started to permeate healthcare and medical education. So I think it was partly timing and partly that they had done a lot of work in what they first identified as an important communicative area and were ready to open up another.
So what did you learn then about the way in which medical teams operate?
Oh my gosh, I've learned so much. It depends which kinds of teams and which studies. So we've learned a lot about how learning to talk the talk as a medical trainee shapes the way you think about your role. So when we study, for instance, how third-year medical clerks learn to present a patient case on morning rounds to the rest of the team, we've learned a lot about the socializing power of language. You want to sound like you belong, and in sounding like you belong, you take on certain attitudes, not only technical vocabularies, but also attitudes towards both aspects of the patient's condition. So, for instance, is their social situation as important as their pressing acute biomedical problem? When you learn to tell the story in a certain way and put one of those things in the foreground and another in the background, that shapes your attitude about medicine, and you take that forward into your professional identity. Mm-hmm. So we've learned about that, the socializing power of language. We've also learned about how language on practicing teams functions to help people get things done, sometimes with unintended consequences. So, for instance, we spent 10 years studying teams in the operating room, looking at how surgeons and anesthesiologists and nurses communicate together to deliver care. And one of the things that we did was identify a number of patterns of communication breakdown that were recurrent across different kinds of surgical procedures with different team members. And we designed an intervention to try and address those communication breakdowns. Other people in the world were working on that particular area as well. And eventually, all of that body of research was taken by the World Health Organization and turned into the Safer Surgery Checklist. So that in the Western world and many parts of the less developed world as well, before a surgery starts, operating room team members will go through a checklist, which is designed to make sure they share what they know. They understand one another's explicit and implicit assumptions about how things will proceed. And they have a plan for how they will adapt if needed.
Mm-hmm. So looking at, say, what happens in a team. So I'm going in for surgery. I have no say in what's going to happen to me. I'm out. There's this team of whatever, five or six people. I want them to be the best that they can be at what they do. Clearly, that's an important consideration in my outcome. But how much is the communicative aspect? What burden of importance does it have in an outcome in a surgery situation?
Its importance is central. So in order for your team members to be the best that they can be, they need to be both individually technically proficient and competent in their knowledge about the condition and the management plan. And they need to be collectively competent and adaptive. They need to be able to work together. We can look at a number of situations. The operating room is not unique in this regard. A number of situations in healthcare where four or five individually competent individuals come together to form an incompetent team. And language is one of the major factors in that, an ability to communicate with one another, to coordinate through information sharing, explicit adjustment of plan, feedback loops, that kind of thing.
Is it that they're not communicating enough, or that they're using different languages, or they're not understanding each other's cues? Where does...
So it's all of the above. So we train, particularly with intense specialization, we train people to focus on different things, to have different areas of expertise, and to have different language for talking about those things, and different expectations of how things therefore should unfold. So partly it's different language. Partly it's the way healthcare is structured. So it's structured very much episodically. You'll have a visit with the surgeon, you'll have a visit with the anesthesiologist, you might have a visit with the cardiologist. And so those episodes, we spend a lot of time structuring those and worrying about the quality of those episodic interactions. But there's very little in our structure to draw all those things together. The mm-hmm. electronic health record was lauded as the solution to that problem. And of course, it has not been, in part because the architecture of the health record is such that any health provider who logs in may well see a different page or a different aspect of the record. So it hasn't made seamless communication. It just means that everybody opens a different folder and types in a different text box.
So this is still very much a work in progress, clearly. I mean, to what extent are medical schools now incorporating this as a central aspect of education and in training doctors?
So I think one of the most important developments in the last 20 years is that healthcare and health professional education both acknowledge wholeheartedly the role of communication in effective care delivery. Nobody's arguing against that. Mm-hmm. And there have been a number of efforts in healthcare and in health professions education to try and offer communication training, to try and alter structures so that they benefit communication. So, for instance, having morning rounds at a time and a place that it can be interprofessional, where not just the physicians are rounding, but you can have some of the bedside nurses rounding, you can have some of the other important team members rounding as well. There are lots of structural innovations that are being tried to help make possible the communication that we acknowledge is important. Mm-hmm. The other huge factor, though, I think, is time. Probably the most expensive commodity in healthcare is time. Mm-hmm. And good communication is going to take some time. Doesn't need to take a lot of time, and we can do it in efficient ways, but it does take time. It needs to be worked into the process.
So how do you teach medical students to be better communicators, to sort of break down some of those barriers and be aware of the potential pitfalls of not communicating effectively?
So one of the dominant initiatives globally in the last decade and a half is what we call interprofessional education, which are efforts to teach students from the various health professional disciplines together. So, for instance, a number of schools offer an event which brings all of those health professional trainees together around a topic that is going to illustrate their interdependence. So a very common topic is pain management. Pain mm-hmm. management is going to require not only medical expertise, but nursing expertise, quite possibly social work intervention, maybe dietetics, pharmacy. It also may be a public health issue. So these interprofessional education events are designed to highlight the role of collaboration and language and get people thinking about that early on in their training. The challenge is that because they're very difficult to schedule, you're not only trying to schedule something in one faculty, but you're trying to coordinate schedules among multiple faculties. They tend to be quite episodic. Increasingly, people know we need more longitudinal curriculum to keep people cycling back to those experiences and developing their insights mm-hmm. about what it means to work on a team. But that remains challenging.
To what extent then is this kind of a systemic issue in terms of how the medical profession defines itself or how a medical professional defines himself? I mean, you go through medical school and you specialize in a certain field and you think of yourself as, you know, the surgeon, the ER doctor, the anesthetologist, the person who knows that field, and that becomes your self-definition. So is this also a matter of learning to define yourself differently in relation to your connection to all these other aspects of medicine?
Yes, that's exactly right. We're trying to have people understand the interdependence of healthcare expertise, that it's a rare situation where a single healthcare provider will be able to respond fully and effectively to a patient's needs. Far more likely they are going to have to respond to the piece that they can, identify the other dimensions of that need, and reach out to the right people. And then after that, they need to coordinate information and plans. It's one thing to diagnose and refer. It's quite another to be circling back and saying, well, how is what the nephrologist is doing going to interact with what the cardiologist is doing for this patient who has multiple chronic problems? And many, many patients in the system now have multiple chronic problems. Uh-huh.
So I guess bringing it back to rhetoric. So why is language sort of at the nexus of those issues and concerns?
Well, everything is language. Everything is language. And so often I will say to, in an only partly teasing way to an audience, that I challenge them to leave the room after the keynote, go back to their clinical setting, put duct tape across their mouth, and achieve what they need to achieve in the rest of the day. The knowledge they hold in their head, the technical proficiency they hold in their hands, the values and attitudes they hold in their heart, those are really important, but they are insufficient because language is the glue that holds it all together. Now, obviously, I'm a rhetorician. I have a hammer, and I will turn everything into a nail. I turn everything into language. And so things like organizational psychology, individual personality, all of these things are important, too. But for me, they're not what jumps off the page. What jumps off the page is the role of people's language, mostly oral, but also the written structures that we have trained people to use.
And you came to that knowledge through a humanities-based education. So I guess, you know, the logical next question is, to what extent can the humanities offer something to people in medicine and in terms of improving those skills and having a more holistic sense of them in a way that would benefit them in their practice?
So I want to return to the metaphor of the enemy camp to answer that question, because when you are within the land of medicine and healthcare, you realize what a lot of folks who are outside maybe don't appreciate, which is that medical education, I'll speak specifically about, medical education is very embracing of different disciplinary perspectives, lenses, orientations. So this field of medical education, which is probably only 30 years old as a discipline, as a research field, it houses all kinds of interesting people. Mm-hmm. In our center, the Center for Education, Research, and Innovation, we have a systems engineer, we have a rhetorician, we have a measurement and evaluation person from education. There are cognitive psychologists in the field. There are sociologists in the field. So medical education has really thrown the doors wide open and said, please bring your tools and help us grapple with our problems. So arts and humanities is another example of that. Medicine and medical education, and the other health professions as well, have realized that the arts and humanities may provide a vehicle for us to grapple with some things that the biomedical aspects of the way we do things don't allow us to grapple with. Things like the concern in the field that as the field becomes more technically advanced and delicate, as biomedical knowledge grows at leaps and bounds, we risk losing the humanity of healthcare, the humanity of medicine, which is what brought many people to medical training in the first place.
So I guess given that, you know, this effort's been made over many years now, is there some sense of how effective the humanities is in bringing some kind of more holistic approach into medical practice?
So that effectiveness question has created quite a debate in the field. There were some reviews of curricular interventions drawing on arts and humanities in medical education. Those reviews are a few years old now. And they concluded, for the most part, that there was not strong evidence for the effectiveness of arts and humanities training. However, there are a number of drawbacks to those reviews. And one of them is that using systematic review methodology that we use in medicine, they exclude most of the non-quantitative experimental studies, studies that don't have control groups, studies that don't have validated instruments, etc., thus excluding quite a bit of the work that has its roots in arts and humanities. As you can imagine, there's a bit of an epistemological disconnect between quantitative measurement and the spirit of arts and humanities work. So we published a review in 2016 where we actually tried to advance that argument one step further. And we looked at the quantitative evidence, but instead of asking, is it effective? We asked questions like, how are the arts and humanities conceptualized when people try and put them to work in the service of medical education? What are they trying to use them to do? And in fact, what we found found in part explains why we don't have good effectiveness evidence. We found that the arts and humanities are used to do three very different kinds of things depending on the curricular innovation. One of the things that we use the arts and humanities to do in medical education is to train skills, to train expertise. So there's a theory that people will become better communicators if you use some arts and humanities, if you have them read, if you have them reflectively writing, etc. A second way we use in the arts and humanities is for more perspective taking, a sort of a more of a dialogic stance. So people will get better at understanding the person's experience of illness if they read poetry, read novels, go view art that captures that experience. So there's arts and humanities to improve skills or expertise, arts and humanities for perspective taking, and then the third and final way it was used was arts and humanities for transformative purposes. And the best example I can give you of that is people using various arts and humanities tools to help transform something fundamentally problematic in the profession, like physician burnout. So physicians being burnt out and lacking resilience, having lost the purpose, the meaning of their work, there's a sense that arts and humanities can have a transformative effect. So just stepping back from that and saying if you're using it in those three very different ways, then yes, you're going to have trouble making a blanket statement, is it effective or is it not? You're going to have trouble mm-hmm. putting all of those things into one bucket.
But they all seem like good things to be doing. So shouldn't we be trying to do all of those things? And aren't the arts and humanities useful ways of promoting those goals? I mean, when you talk about physician burnout, I mean, that seems a major issue and definitely one I expect that the profession itself doesn't always want to look at too closely. I suspect also within the medical profession, there's a kind of attitude of having to sort of take it or of being strong in the face of the difficulties that medicine presents. It starts right from medical school. So isn't that a good area that we should be looking at and where the arts and humanities might have something to offer?
Yes, it is a good area to look at. And in fact, I don't know of anyone who's arguing that we shouldn't mm-hmm. use the arts and humanities. The argument usually comes down to resources and curricular time. It usually comes down to, well, if they have to learn all this biomedical material, then where will we fit this? And that's when the effectiveness claim comes in. Well, if you're mm-hmm. going to take something else out to make room for that, then we need to be sure that this is actually doing what we want it to do. Thus, that effectiveness debate. People recognize that these challenges in medicine and healthcare are foundational and profound, and they recognize that arts and humanities has something to offer. It's just kind of the, what exactly is the something? What's the dose required, to use one of their metaphors? How do we know how much would be enough to actually have the effect that we're hoping to have in any one of those arts and humanities innovations? That's where the debate is now. I would say, too, that the other part, the counter voice in that debate is to leave space for the arts and humanities to do what it does and not to dose it. So part of the arts and humanities is about reflexivity and thoughtfulness and passion and humanity and story, and you can't always dose those things. Mm-hmm. And so this is part of the debate as well, is a recognition that it's important, a desire to make arguments for, well, how much would we need in the curriculum and where and how, in what way, and then an argument to say arts and humanities is another kind of thing, and for it to work, you have to let it be this other kind of thing. It's a fascinating conversation right now in health professions education.
I wonder the extent to which, you know, in terms of how doctors themselves think of themselves and how they characterize the kind of language they use to think about themselves. I mean, is that something you look at as a rhetorician, as opposed to communicating with others, but their own kind of self-image, and to what extent that feeds into burnout? I mean, they're going through intense experiences on a daily basis that they will then characterize in particular ways. Is that an area that you yourself are are working in or doing any research on?
So one of my colleagues at the center, Dr. Taryn Taylor, her whole series of doctoral studies was looking at how postgraduate medical trainees, so those people who are doing their specialty training, how they grapple with fatigue, which is a profound issue in training, but also how the surroundings, the culture of their training sends them both explicit and tacit messages about fatigue, about how they should respond to fatigue. Should they admit being fatigued? Should they hero on through that fatigue? So this is also a really timely debate right now because many countries in the world have duty hours. So in Europe, there are restrictions on duty hours. In Canada, we haven't imposed the same kinds of restrictions, but for trainees, we do have rules, for instance, that they're supposed to go home when they're post-call after they've done an overnight 24-hour shift. And so how that gets negotiated is very much socializing trainees into a particular attitude towards fatigue. For instance, many trainees believe that they'll get better at it and become gradually less tired. The scientific evidence does not bear this out. We just had a medical student interview other medical students about their experience of fatigue. And one of the things that came out in that work, which is also led by Dr. Taylor, was that medical students look forward to the groups above them and believe, well, it must get better or those people wouldn't be doing so well. So this kind of sense that, oh, I feel horribly fatigued, but I guess if I just soldier on, I'm either going to not notice it as much or I'm going to somehow get more sleep at the next stage of my training because those people look as though they're faring okay.
And are they faring okay, those people?
Well, they're not getting more sleep, I'll tell you that. You don't get more sleep as you become more expert in the field necessarily. It depends on what specialty you're in, but generally, no.
Now, I know you've been doing work in other sort of more subtle types of communication that occur, you know, within medical teams. You've been looking at silence, looking at the use of metaphor. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about silence. So for many, many years, I studied what people say in team situations because that's the obvious stuff. And then it was only when we were going across a number of studies and looking at transcripts and some kind of interesting strange things in the transcripts that we realized that we'd spent many years ignoring everything people didn't say. And so we wrote a series of papers looking at patterns of silence on interprofessional teams, mostly in the operating room, and talking about how silence is actually a communication strategy, particularly in team situations where there's a strong power differential. So when there's a hierarchy on the team, sometimes silence and nonverbal communication is a better way to achieve something together, particularly when overt communication might create conflict. So yes, we've done some work on silence. I've also been interested for many years on the role of humor in healthcare work. Humor is a form of language that is really important, does important things for socialization. It does important things for people's ability to sort through and navigate some of the difficult situations they find themselves in when they're practicing. But there's very little empirical research to understand exactly what it's doing and how it's doing that.
So it gets pretty subtle when you start looking at that level of interaction. How do you measure these things? How do you gauge these things in terms of what's actually happening in any given situation?
It's so interesting that you would use the word measure. I expect that from the enemy camp. I don't expect it from you. So this has been a really interesting journey. I've been doing this for more than 20 years, and part of what I and other people who use social science kinds of qualitative, naturalistic research methods, part of what we have done in this field over 20 years is teach our peers and colleagues about what it means to study something that you cannot measure, mm-hmm. that you cannot control. You can't take all the confounding variables out. Usually that's what I'm most interested in, is all the confounding variables. So what does it mean to nevertheless systematically explore a phenomena that can't be measured and controlled and dosed in a certain way? For me, the litmus test of a good study of language on a healthcare team is when I get up to describe the results of the study and every head in the room does a slow nod as if, yes, that is completely my world. That's my lingo. That's what I hear every morning on rounds. And then they stop nodding and their pupils dilate. And that you can see them say, but I never quite saw it that way before. So for me, what we're trying to get here, and it's not the measure, but the reaction we're looking for is, you completely nailed my lingo, and I'll never quite feel the same way when I use it. That's what I'm going for.
What you're describing to me here is how I feel when I read an Alice Munro short story. That
absolutely.
That moment when you get that visceral sense of something that has never quite been articulated in that way before, but makes that sudden intuitive sense. So it seems to me that, you know, you're bringing that the kind of complexity that literature takes for granted to the study of medical communication. So I'm completely on board with not trying to quantify experiences like that, but I can understand the difficulty of communicating that in a field that expects quantitative reports, which I guess brings me to, you know, the big question that sort of runs through all these podcasts that we're doing is the issue of creativity. And it seems to me that what you're doing is really a kind of textbook definition of creativity. You're essentially involved in creating a domain of study where none had existed before, and looking at this kind of communication and in looking at it in a way in which the field itself would normally not look at it. What are your thoughts on the creativity aspect of what you're doing?
I think my first thought is to say that I have been incredibly blessed to have the freedom to do this. So I am an academic faculty member who has always had what's called an alternate workload. I have most of my time reserved for research. Without that, I don't think I would ever have had the time to make all of these collaborative connections with clinicians, to learn their language, to go observe in their world and understand it well enough that we could sit down together and design a study. That requires so much time that I feel first blessed to have had that kind of faculty position that allowed me to do it. Secondarily, I think that we have always been welcome to come in and watch and listen. And I could not have been creative without those early eavesdropping sessions and then having clinical collaborators to come back to and say, what was that all about? And then debriefing with them. As I said before, the door is open, come on in, listen, watch, and then help us use your lenses to address something that is really important for medical education. So that's been really key. Then I think the third thing that's been key is my curiosity about how language works. I wouldn't have called it creativity, except that your podcast has that title. For me, it's a sense of curiosity and then an ability to follow where the curiosity leads and the network and community to support me going where it leads. Those are the things. I get why you call it creativity, but that's the key for me.
Another textbook definition of creativity is following your curiosity is okay. The starting point for every creative idea. So clearly, also in how you're bringing together fields that would normally be brought together, and that's often the point at which new ideas start, in that crossing of domains, that crossing of fields. I don't want to put you on the spot, but you know, we're here now. We're communicating, we're using language, we're doing it in a format, a podcast, that I'm new to. I'm learning the ropes. Are there any pointers you can give me about this experience and how it's unfolding that might be useful to me going forward?
This podcast conversation?
Yeah.
I can tell you that the fact that this is our second conversation is very helpful. Because as we said when we met outside in the hallway, we've met before. So there's a recognition that I think allows this conversation to be a little bit more free and deep than the first conversation was. I think the other thing is that I have not felt in this conversation as though I had to defend my people. Interesting. I'm a very interdisciplinary person. Who mm-hmm. are my people? But I, you know, my people are the people who I study and the people who then, you know, take this work and hopefully build educational curriculum and practices from it. Those are my people. So being able to tell you about what it's like to live in that world and tell stories about that world and not feel as though I was telling tales on them, that's, mm-hmm. I think, a really important part of making a podcast like this work.
And I certainly get that sense from how you talk about what you do, that you're not in there trying to find a problem to solve so much as to examine the complexity of a situation that's really hard to get to the bottom of. Would that be?
Yes. I think that there's so much about healthcare communication that's challenging. So much of it is problematic. And yet you have these people who manage, in spite of that, to deliver very high quality care the vast majority of the time. I'm interested in how they do that mm-hmm. and how does language enable that. Mm-hmm. I'm also, of course, going to find the places where language has unintended consequences that are problematic. But mm-hmm. you look around, you see these people who are enormously motivated, enormously bright, very fluent in their own languages, and they're managing, often rolling the stone uphill in our healthcare system, which is broken in some important ways. They're managing to get the work done well. How does that work? Mm-hmm.
I know one of the areas you're working in is metaphor and how metaphors get used. And I've noticed some of the metaphors you've been using, which kind of draw from one discipline, put into another, the metaphor of dosing, of confounding variables. So where do you want to go with this? How do you see metaphor as important within the field?
So metaphor, I think, is a really useful heuristic. I do use it all the time. I use it conceptually, but also conversationally, the way I have uh-huh. today. And when I try and explain to a medical colleague what's metaphor, I say, well, it's comparing two things that seem like they don't fit, but in comparing them, you get an insight you didn't have before. So for me to say dosing the art seems like it doesn't fit, but it gives you an insight into the tensions between those two worlds. I talk about metaphor a lot when I talk about my research to large audiences. So I said I studied teams. One of the things I do quite regularly in a keynote is I point out to people that in healthcare, we like to use the team metaphor, which is a very kind of mechanistic metaphor. It's a machine metaphor. Get all these different parts and you put them together on a team. And if they're all functioning well, the team will function well. And in fact, that machine metaphor is very limiting for thinking about healthcare collaboration or the healthcare collective and the work it's doing together. So I will quite often sort of put up a picture of a machine and say, well, this is the metaphor we're using, whether you are explicit about it or not. And then I'll put up a video of flocking birds. And I'll say, this is a metaphor that actually might help us imagine some other elements of this. So for a flock of birds, it's not any individual part of that flock that shapes what the group does. It's features like geography or a windstorm. So then I'll say to them, so in your critical care unit team, instead of worrying about whether everybody's got the right knowledge or technical skills, that's important. But what if we also asked, what's a windstorm in the critical care unit that would actually change the direction of our flocking? To try and help people see that different metaphors can shake them out of their commonplace perception of a thing. I just wrote a chapter last year, which is coming out in a book on the medical humanities this summer, and it's on metaphors of clinical supervision. And it tries to put forward that the metaphors we use for talking about how we supervise trainees while they're doing clinical work, that those have really powerful implications for the relationships we set up with trainees, for what we expect of them. So one metaphor, for instance, is the gatekeeper. Okay, you're going to work on my patients, but only so much because I am the gatekeeper here. I'm safeguarding this patient population. And there are lots of metaphors that we use conversationally, but that actually rhetorically shape the way we think about that really central medical education practice.
Mm-hmm. And have you seen situations where behavior has changed if the metaphor has changed?
I don't know that I could say that behavior has changed. Behavior is measurable. What I can see is that people will sit back in their chair and then they may begin to sort of playfully experiment with that metaphor with me. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So what is the geography of the critical care unit that's going to really take us off course? There's a willingness to play and conceptualize differently. How and whether that translates into behavior change, I can't think of a concrete example that I could share with you in the moment.
Like, how do you talk about that other element, the much subtler, you know, the subtler shift that's what you're actually looking for? It's, you know, it's like that flock of birds. You only know it, you know, it's probably taken millions of years of evolution for them to be able to move with that kind of synchrony. So it feels like you're engaged in a long-term project, really, because the things you're dealing with are ephemeral and deep tissue. Is that how you feel about what you're doing?
That is how I feel about what I'm doing. It's why questions like how effective is arts and humanities in medical education are so difficult, because I understand where the questions are coming from. And yet, if you had the most profound impact possible with an arts and humanities curriculum, would you see the outcome? Could I look at you and say, there's a novelist who uses metaphor? No, I would have to be in your head and asking you to think out loud while you discarded metaphors and found another one and tried another one. And so we're not producing a change that's measurable using the tools that medical education has tended to use. And as a consequence, it's one of two things. It's either important and invisible, or it's not there. It's the emperor's clothes. And so that's a very difficult space to be in if you're wanting to advocate for the power of a humanities view, of arts and humanities curriculum, of interdisciplinarity, in a space where there is still a prioritization of measurable outcomes. It's very tricky. It helps to be a rhetorician.
It seems as if we know it's important, but because we can't show it's important, we don't get action.
Well, so you're going to love this answer. The only way we can show it's important is through story. Uh-huh. So you can boil down my research to the ability to tell stories that resonate with people and make them think a little bit differently about their own lives. I can't measure much, but I don't need to, maybe, if the story can shift their thinking, if the story sets up a different kind of relation between them and their world. So really, I mean, it was only partly teasing when I said it helps to be a rhetorician. I study language, but also my own vehicle for trying to translate what I learn is language. I tell stories and I try and convince people to see the world slightly differently than they did before.
Uh-huh. So you're kind of a subversive element inserted into the fabric that gently shifts things in a certain direction that hopefully will go on over time? I mean, are there more of you out there, I guess, is a question.
Yes. Yes. In fact, in the field of health professions education, as I said before, there's quite a delicious variety mm-hmm. of academics and researchers bringing approaches from other fields to medical education. And there is a sense of subversion to that, except that it's subversion, a subversion that's not only welcome, but also being paid for. Mm-hmm. The faculties of medicine are employing people like me to do this work. So that says something I think really important about the domain of medical education, that it would bring these subversive elements in an attempt to try and get some answers to some really challenging educational questions.
So is your impact more at the practice level? I mean, how can you integrate this, say, at the level of medical education in medical school, as opposed to, you know, being there in the field and working with actual practitioners?
So I would conceive of my impact as being on a number of levels. Increasingly, I'm trying to have my impact be at the level of policy. So with the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada, for instance, they have shifted to a competency-based medical education approach. I am spending a lot of time trying to write and speak about the importance of collective competence, not just individual competence, and drawing on my research to try and get that infused into the way that people think about competency-based education. That's one example. I gave you another example earlier where the work that we did with operating room teams was taken up alongside a lot of other research in the world to create this checklist, which is a protocol really for trying to guide communications preoperatively. There are also, you know, these interprofessional education initiatives that draw on research like mine and others to create these educational experiences for undergraduate health professional students. So it can be taken up at multiple levels. I think one of the ways I conceive of my role is to tell these stories in ways that they are amenable to a variety of uptakes.
Mm-hmm. Do they have any need for novelists?
Always. Always.
And so, you know, after you've been through a team, do they... are they likely to pick up a novel afterwards? And does it have a? Do they feel moved, I guess, to start thinking about communication more intensely and more subtly?
So I think after we've studied a team setting and had that relationship where we're observing and interviewing and coming back and saying, well, here's kind of what we're starting to think is going on, and sort of iteratively cycling that knowledge up with the team, I think that if we do that well, a few things will happen. One is that they will invite us back again. If you don't get invited back again, you know that you actually did something very wrong in your field research, because you should be seen as someone who actually can go and tell the story of that world. It's not always a perfectly pretty story, but it ought to be a respectful and understanding story. So we'll get invited back. Usually also there will be an increased awareness and respect for qualitative social science research methods. Often when we work with a team to study their environment and their communication practices, they don't know anything about this kind of research until they get engaged in it with us. So usually I would expect that their awareness would go up and that their respect for that would go up, and they might be less dismissive of that approach to science in the future. Mm-hmm. And then I think the final thing would be that I would hope that what we would have given them, what we would have given back to them, is some language, a few phrases or words that capture in a kind of different way something that's central to their communication practices. And if they carry those words or phrases forward and give feedback or express things slightly differently, that for me would be the extent of quote-unquote behavior change that I would look for immediately connected to my research, giving people just a slightly different vocabulary for talking about something that's really important to their practice.
Mm-hmm. And it must often feel liberating for them to have a way of solving a problem with language that they hadn't thought of or foreseen or understood?
I don't know. I have never asked them how they felt about it. I know that sometimes it's quite unnerving for people to be studied. And as we go through the process, they worry quite a bit about how they're going to be portrayed in the story. I don't know if your family members wonder if they're going to be portrayed poorly in your stories, but
some of them don't speak to me.
So I'm hoping that all of my research participants will continue to speak to me. But we have had the odd situation where a team was really not happy with, or members of a team were not happy with the story we told about their teamwork. And we try and negotiate that, but at the end of the day, that's the story that there is to tell.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and it's been enlightening to me as well. You know, as I say, I now see the operating theater as really a kind of an unfolding short story, operating at that level of complexity and of intuitive understanding that sometimes works brilliantly and occasionally, you know, has these areas that could be improved. And I commend you on the work that you've been doing.
Thank you.
I'm Nino Ricci, and this has been Who Do You Think You Are? A Western University Podcast.